Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of the new screensavers is brought to you by Upside, the smart new way to save big on business travel. Visit Upside.com and enter the code NSS, and you're guaranteed at least a $100 gift card when you book your first trip. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with the one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/NSS.
Hands-on with the PlayStation VR AIM controller, Raspberry Pi as media centers, Google Family Link on Android. Live from the Tweet Eastside Studios from beautiful Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
Screensavers, it's episode 104 from May 13th, 2017. I am not Leo Laporte. I'm actually Father Robert Ballasaire, joined by Aaron Newcomb. He's the maker extraordinaire. Aaron, so good to see you again.
Yeah, glad to be back on. It's been a little while, so I'm glad to be back on. We got some exciting stuff to talk about that I know I'm jazzed up about. So
Yes, indeed. And I will say, neither of us are Leo Laporte. Leo is actually stuck in Colorado right now. He developed a little bit of a flu. He's okay, but he'll be back. His doctor just said you probably shouldn't be on a plane while you're sick, which, by the way, is good advice for everyone. I'm sure you've run into that a couple of times.
I have, unfortunately, yeah. It's not good for you. It's not good for the other people on the plane. So better just, you know, rest, stay in bed and rest and get over it before you venture out in an enclosed tin can.
Yeah, yeah. Last time I came back from Europe, I was actually on a 16-hour flight. Mm-hmm. Sitting right next to a woman who was just getting progressively worse and worse. Oh. And she was just coughing on everything. I was like, well, that's...
Nothing you can do.
Nope.
Nothing you can do.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I am officially an incubator. How about that? Now, we do have a great show.
Yes.
We're going to be talking about PlayStation VR. We've got some tips and tricks from the Twit staff here about things ranging from the Nintendo Switch all the way over to Android world. And, of course, we've got some wonderful... in-studio surprises, so you're going to want to stay tabbed. But first, you know what I wanted to do? Leo always has such wonderful gadgets.
Yes.
And it's fun to wander over to his office when he's not here and to play with them. Hopefully Leo's not watching this right now. But I've got a couple of gadgets of my own. In fact, I just got back. I had a 31-hour trip from Malta to Amsterdam to JFK.
Wow.
I spent a week going through Europe doing church things. One company actually saw me tweet about this, and they asked me if I wanted to borrow their non-roaming hotspot.
Oh, nice.
So this is it. This is called the Glocal Me. Now, it doesn't look like anything special. It's just basically a battery and a couple of radios and a Wi-Fi access point.
It's like a small cell phone without a screen.
It does, yeah. And, you know, it lasts for, 12 hours on its battery, but... surprisingly, it did exactly what I needed it to do. This gave me very high-speed service in Rome, in Amsterdam, in Malta, basically anywhere I stopped on the way. I don't know about you, but when I go overseas, typically one of the very first things I do is I get a SIM
for
my card. But if you're jumping from country to country to country, that gets expensive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This way, I was able to get one device, and this one device saw me through. I was pleasantly surprised.
So you didn't need a SIM? You didn't need to put anything
in? No SIM. No nothing. Now, it does have two SIM slots, a regular SIM size and the nano SIM, in case you want to do that. But you could just use the service. So there's a central portal. You load it up with credits. I think I had $50 on this. I used this for a solid week, and there was still $23 left on it. We're going to be doing a full review on this because I think this is probably a good thing for travelers.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, something else. I know you're a geek like myself.
I am, yeah.
Do you like storage?
I love storage, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been a storage admin, a storage architect, worked in the storage industry for 15, 20 years. So, yeah, I know a little bit about it.
Do you remember 2 years ago at CES, Kingston actually made some buzz by showing off a 1 terabyte flash drive, which was ridiculous because 1 terabyte.
Right.
They were in studio yesterday for This Week in Enterprise Tech, and they dropped off a couple of goodies. Oh, I dropped them on the floor. This is one of them. This says goodbye to the 1 terabyte flash drive. This is actually a 2 terabyte flash drive.
Wow.
It's a USB 3, so it will do 200 megabytes per second read-write, if I can get it out of the awesome packaging. But any guesses as to how much this might cost?
Oh, my word. It's got to be, what, $500, $600?
All right, keep going.
$1,000, $2,000?
Keep going.
Seriously?
No, okay. $1,500.
Oh, okay.
It's a unique product. It's one of a kind, but I got to say, just the idea of having a 2 terabyte flash drive, this basically replaces all of my travel storage.
Right.
I don't know if I would actually be able to afford this, and this review unit eventually has to go back. But, we're going to do a full review on this as well.
That might be good for some other topics we're going to talk about later.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case you get struck by something that was in the news this week.
Oh,
we'll talk about that in a
minute. Yeah. I know what you did there. That was a tease.
Yeah, it was a tease.
I've heard about these. They use them in our industry. But the last little bit of gadget prawn that I really, really enjoy, I've been salivating over this thing since I saw the mock-up a year ago. I wanted it at CES. They finally released it. You like fast SSDs, right?
Absolutely. You got to have them.
Now, here is one. This, again, is from Kingston. This is a 1.6 terabyte array. It uses PCIe. It's Revision 3, 8 lanes. And, a fast SSD, like a really fast NVMe SSD from Intel, might get you 2.5 gigabytes per second.
That sounds about right.
Maybe about 100 to 150 IOPS.
Yep.
This will do 7 gigabytes per second and over a million IOPS.
Wow, that's incredible.
And essentially what they've done here, you can't tell because they've got this heatsink, but there's 4 M.2 cards. They've linked them together with a single switch. It's a silicone switch. Very little latency is added, but it allows you to get multiple devices into those same 8 PCIe lanes in case you're running out in your system.
Right, right.
Now,
wait a second, though. When you say, what do you need to run this thing? I know you're going to cover it or have covered it in more detail, but do you need the latest PCIe technology on a motherboard to be able
you
to
You need Revision 3.
Okay.
So this will
not
work
the TV
in...
Not show.
No.
The network. Okay.
You need a Revision 3 PCIe
got it,
slot.
Got it.
Because if you have a Revision 2, this will work, but the problem is Revision 2 is half as fast as Revision 3.
Right.
So instead of having 8 lanes of 1 gigabyte per second, you get 8 lanes of 500 megabytes per second.
It's going to cut everything down by half.
Yeah, so why get the super fast card if you're not going to have a PC that can run it?
Yeah.
This is not really made for consumer boxes.
Yep.
It's an enterprise product. This is perfect for transactional servers. But you know there's a geek out there who's thinking, I'm going to get bragging rights, drop this in.
Yeah, definitely.
About a dollar a gigabyte. So
okay.
If you do the math, that's about $1,600.
Yeah, that's actually not bad.
There's like more than $3,000 worth of storage on this table, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the cost, though, has come down. You know, when I was in the industry, this type of technology, whether you were using, depending if you're using SSDs or NAND or whatever it was, is probably 10 times that. And this is just maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So the cost has come down dramatically on this, and it's all due to scale and everything else. But that's just incredible that you can get that much throughput out of that card. A single card in a PC, it's tremendous. Anybody that's running a database or anything like that, you ought to be salivating over this thing.
Yeah, well, we're going to be doing thorough reviews on all of this gear on future episodes of New Screensavers and on Know How and on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Awesome.
I will say, do you remember there was a startup, 10 years ago? It was a Paul Allen-funded startup called Fusion.io.
Yeah, it was bought by SanDisk.
Yeah, they did a $250,000 array that wasn't as fast as that.
Yep.
So it just shows you, and that was all proprietary. This is literally off the shelf. They took 4 M.2s, took a off-the-shelf controller switch, and then they wrote custom firmware to make it work properly. So kudos to them for making this thing work properly.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's incredible.
All right, now we got to move on because we've got some hot topic. Now, Aaron, this last week I was originally supposed to go to Microsoft Build. Unfortunately, this job kind of pulled me away. Really wanted to be there. There were a couple of interesting announcements that I think are going to affect everyone from the developer all the way to the average home geek.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, I'm going to have to rely on you. I'm not the biggest Windows aficionado that I'm out there. Linux, yeah, fine. That's okay. But not so much for Windows. But I heard about this in the news. What's going on?
Okay, so for developers, I think the big thing was Microsoft's big movement into database as a service. As a service has been a movement for a very long time. Get everything into the cloud. But what they've done is they've now created a way to have a consistent experience of that as a service, nice. Of that web service. So in other words, if I want high availability, I can pay for it. Mm-hmm. If I am okay with best effort, I can pay a lower price. But they're making it so that I can actually guarantee the level of service that I'm going to get through a web service, which is that's not easy.
It's not easy. I mean, other companies have tried to do this. Obviously, Amazon AWS does this with their RDS service. Oracle has certainly been trying to tap into this, right? They're the database experts, so they have touted their cloud database service as well. So I think this is just a natural fit for Microsoft to go after this as well. It makes total sense.
Right. Now, there's also a bunch of new APIs, which we'll go in depth on other shows. I know Windows Weekly has touched on it. I know that Twilight is going to touch on it. But for the home user, the big thing is the release of the new update to Windows 10.
Yeah.
Lots of added features, everything from new integration in the store to my personal favorite. Do you remember Windows Movie Maker?
I do, yeah. I used it back in the day before I said, this kind of sucks. I'm going to try to use something else. But I remember a lot of people, especially like, you know, kids in schools and things like that, they would use that for their school projects. It was easy. It was available. So they'd use it all the time. Then it kind of went away.
It did. And that bothered people. It was one of those things that people didn't realize they liked it until they could no longer get it.
Right.
It got updated out of Windows, I think, right around Vista, the Vista years. It just kind of went away.
Disappeared.
Super simple package to use. It wasn't the most advanced. It wasn't even an iMovie. But for someone who just wanted to put some clips together, it actually worked really, really well. They've brought it back. Well,
nice. They've
kind of brought it back. It's the spiritual successor. This one is called Story Remix 3D.
Ah.
I've actually been really impressed with what Microsoft has been doing with some of these apps. Like their 3D app is not the greatest, but it will bring in an audience that otherwise wouldn't play with that technology. I think this is the same thing. This is not an Adobe Premiere. This is not Final Cut. This is not Avid. But if you're one of these people who say, hey, I receive a video from Google every once in a while for the latest trip or the latest collection of pictures, I didn't quite like the way they did it, you can use this to make your own, and it looks really good.
Yeah. Well, as long as it's easy to use, I mean, I think that's the critical thing. For people that are looking for a product like this, they want something built into their operating system or alongside their operating system that they can use to make these short, simple movies, add in a little sound, and be done with it. It just has to be quick and easy to use, and it looks like it is. Click and drag, put in your photos, put in your videos, add some music, and call it a day. So I think this looks like, anyway, it'll really serve its purpose.
Yeah, and, you know, I will say this is part of a bigger strategy. This is not just a cool new app for Windows. What Microsoft is really doing is they want you to centralize your assets in Windows.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's worked really well for Google. I mean, if you put your pictures on your Google phone, they're automatically synced with your photos. They're automatically available to all your Google apps. Microsoft looks at that, and they envy it. They're like, look, hey, why aren't you using Windows?
Right.
That's already your operating system. Why not dump your pictures in here? Why not sync it with OneDrive? And then we'll make it as easy for you to share and create as you see in this video right here. I got to say, I think it's a winning strategy.
Well, it's a good strategy. I don't know if it's a winning strategy.
Okay, we'll see.
Can they catch up with Google, what Google is doing, what Apple is doing, and really bring in mobile, which is what they're missing right here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not everybody, in fact, I would say not even the majority of people live on a desktop anymore. So it's a tough road to hoe.
Let me ask you this. Do you think they have ever, forever poisoned the mobile well? I mean, there's such a stink about how poorly Microsoft did in mobile that there are those who are saying, no, it's a dead category for them. They're too late. They can't jump back in. And if they do, people are going to remember the mobile Windows and the horrible disaster it was.
I don't think they're going to be able to jump back in with a device.
Yeah.
But they could jump back in with software, right? So if they make this software easy to use on other people's ecosystems, that meaning basically Apple and Android, then they could capture mindshare. And they started doing that with Office 360
and
all of that, right? And people actually liked that. They're like, hey, this is pretty cool, especially for businesses. I can move all my stuff over there. My people already know how to use these applications. It works on my phone, so maybe I'll try it. So I think that's the strategy they should take. We'll see. We'll see if they get there.
And I think you're right. I think you're right along with Satya Nadella. That's been his thing. It's service first.
Yep.
It's cloud first.
Right.
I mean, the database announcements, that's what that was. Look, use it on any platform you want, and it's going to work the same way. If they can nail that as well as they have with Office 365, then I think it is a winning strategy.
Right. All
right. Let's move on from Windows to something that is a little depressing, a little interesting, incredibly terrifying.
Yeah.
You've heard of a little malware attack that kind of spread across Europe, yeah?
Yeah, big news starting really yesterday, right? I mean, or 2 days ago if you're in Europe time.
Right.
But yeah, healthcare getting shut down, transit services, all kinds of things. FedEx got hit by this thing. So really spread across Europe. People were really, I mean, I can't imagine losing access to medical records when a patient comes in. They were actually turning people away because of this ransomware that was going on over in Europe.
And of course, you're talking about the WannaCry ransomware. We're talking about tens of thousands of computers, 104 countries across Europe, Asia, some of the Americas. They used, and I think this is where the story really gets interesting, they used the Eternal Blue toolkit that was part of the NSA tool dump that was sent out by the shadow brokers. And they modified it to turn it into ransomware. And, of course, we know how ransomware works. It crypt locks your computer, and then it demands bitcoins. In this case, they wanted 600 bitcoins per device locked, which is another way of saying, yeah, you're not going to pay for this.
Right.
No one's going to pay $600,000 to unlock a device.
I don't know. I bet there's some companies out there that will, though, right?
it would have to have locked the right device.
Right.
Yeah. But the scary part about this was how quickly it spread. Yeah. It targeted an exploit of zero-day way back in the day for Windows that Microsoft actually patched halfway through March. But unfortunately, as we know, people don't like patching. I'm guilty of this.
I am too. Yeah, I'll see the patch and I'll be like, nah, I don't really want to do the update because I'm just about to play Overwatch and I don't want to reboot the computer right now. But you really have to pay attention to it. That's obviously number one. Is when you see an update like that, especially if it's important. A security update, you got to go out and install it because this could happen, right? I think hopefully the only good news about this is that it'll raise awareness, right, for people to look at their systems. Oh, I do have an update pending. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and do it right now because I don't want to get hit by this thing too. I think we were spared for whatever reason. I don't know in the U.S. I know that there were some impacts in the U.S. as well, but not nearly as much as Europe. So if you're in the U.S.
It was a timing thing.
Yeah, if you're in the U.S., definitely go and make sure your Windows systems are up to date, number one. Right?
There were two mitigations. First, that it was really targeted at Europe. And so by the time we rolled around to U.S. time, we were aware of it. You had ISPs who were already filtering those attacks out.
Yep.
So the impact wasn't felt as greatly in the United States. The second thing was there was actually a British researcher who was looking at the traffic from an infected system and noticed that it kept trying to contact a domain which, oddly enough, wasn't registered. It was either command and control or it was the domain that was going to unlock. So all he had to do was he registered the domain and kept it for himself, and it kind of muted the effects of the malware.
Who is that guy? We got to send him a beer.
I know, right? Or what do they have? Is it a pint? A pint of beer?
Let's send him a pint. Buy him a pint.
I always see the comic legs of beer.
Yeah, the big ones,
I don't think that's actually a thing.
I think that's an American movie thing.
Yeah. Oh, all right. The other thing about this was the fact that when you look at the spread pattern, when you look at what they were aiming for, this is a new chapter in the weaponization of exploits.
Right.
Obviously, it was an NSA toolkit thing, but this is taking advantage of so many issues. One, yes, an insecurity in an operating system, but also taking advantage of the fact that human nature means I think I know best and I'm not going to patch. I do it all the time. I scream at Windows 10 because it always seems to update at the wrong time. It killed a 16-hour render I had going on at Premiere. And I'm thinking, how hard is it to check to see if there's an active process using 90% of the CPU?
Right.
Maybe that's not the best time to update.
Yeah.
It is updated in the middle of a live show, even though I have active hours set. And so there's that side of me that's like, wait a minute, Microsoft, I know what I'm doing. Let me do what I'm doing.
Yep.
But on the other side, but also keep me safe.
Yeah.
And this was important enough where I probably would have accepted it interrupting my 16-hour render.
Yeah, but who knows if it's important, right? I mean, that's kind of the thing. Yeah. Like, we know, right? We know now, but even you might be able to take a look and say, oh, critical security fix, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I want to apply this because I know kind of what that means. The average user doesn't. So the advice has to be, if you're going to get an update, if you see that there's an update pending, just go ahead and apply it, especially if it says anything about security. You know, don't shy away from updating. A couple other good tips. Make sure you have some sort of virus software running at all times, right? Because if you are, some of these can be detected in the virus scanning engines that are out there. Why are you smiling? Did you turn your virus off?
I do not run virus software at all. I run Defender. I will occasionally run anti-malware tools, but I do not run a virus.
So I'm with you actually on this one. Yeah. But you're running Windows Defender, right? So at least that's something. Don't turn that off.
And also, my network is very well secured. Mm-hmm. So I have active policies that don't allow malware to spread from one computer to another within my network if one were to get infected. And they're also really good about screening in incoming traffic. Yep. And they're always looking for exfiltration. Most people don't have that. Yeah. But I hate antivirus software.
It's kind of gotten bad over the years. But at least run Windows Defender, right, if you're running Windows. Right. And then the last thing is, you know, make sure you back up your data. And this is where we get back to this device. Maybe not this device. But go out and buy like a $50, $60, 1 terabyte device. Copy your data over to it.
Oh, by the way, after you copy it, disconnect it.
And then disconnect it. Or,
just
you know,
FYI.
If you're not using cloud backup services, start using them, Google Drive, or even, I hate to say it, Windows OneDrive. I'm not a big fan, but use something, right? Use something. Back up those important files either to a different device or to a cloud service somewhere, because at least then, even if this ransomware infects your system, you can say, screw it. I'll just reinstall everything from scratch, copy my data back over, and my important photos aren't lost, right, from my kids and whatever else.
So. Oh, by the way, quick note about that. We did have this question on KnowHow, whether or not having your data on a NAS would protect it from a crypt lock attack.
Mm-hmm.
No. Right. Just FYI, intelligent crypt locking software will actually, even if you don't map the drive, it will look at the devices that you've connected to and it will attempt to attach to them. If you have your NAS set up so that it just takes your Windows credentials to allow you into the shares, it's the same thing as having connected to your computer. So, for example, on my setup, anytime I access online storage, it asks for my credentials again, and it will not take it from the cache. So that keeps a crypt locking software from accessing that. That's good. But if you can't do that, then back up and then disconnect. Because if it's connected to the computer anyway, the crypt locking software will go after it.
Yep. Yep. Right. Great advice.
Let's move on to something that's a little depressing, to something that's kind of
fun, kind of scary,
I guess. Amazon released a new Echo, their Echo Show, which is nice. Okay. It does things like tell you when you're poorly dressed, which is why I'm not ever going to get one of these. I can see it saying, Robert, I noticed you're wearing black again. Or, you know, no.
I noticed you're wearing stripes with plaid.
You're wearing white after Labor Day.
I actually did that. My wife, when she first started dating me, she's like, you got to redo your wardrobe, man. You can't wear those striped pants and that plaid shirt. That doesn't go together.
Oh, by the way, I've noticed that with my new body, stripes this way are okay. Stripes this way, no.
Not as good, huh?
No, I look like an optical illusion. But more important than Echo Show for me is the update that they did to their voice assistant, specifically the ability to make calls.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, my sister just renovated her house. And one of the things that she did, she wanted a proper kitchen, like a chef's kitchen.
Yeah.
So it's got the big sinks and the countertops and everything's nice. And she made sure that all of the appliances, the sinks, the blenders, the lights, can all be turned on and off with a touch. So you don't have to reach out and hit the switch.
Right. Important when you got your hands full of...
Precisely. You don't want to touch something.
Cookie dough or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you can kind of do that with Echo now. Hmm. You can use it to call. You can use it to text. Well, not to text, but you can use it to access your contact list, mm-hmm. which sounds like a good idea, except people are starting to realize that you can't disable that.
Right, right.
That could be a problem.
That could be a problem, yeah.
Oh, by the way, Josh Windisch, who works here at Twit, he has his Echo on, and he's been complaining that anyone's been able to call him. So, if you have an Echo, contact Josh Windisch. Hey, Josh. You're
don't make
welcome.
Don't make me laugh. It's going to make me cough.
All right, so let's go ahead and move on. It's a fun world. It's an interesting world. A few developments that I think are going to stay with us. We're going to see more from what's been announced at Build.
Yeah.
We're going to see way fallout from this malware attack. And I think Amazon's going to have to start to tweak the Echo and the Echo ecosystem just a tiny bit to make it work properly.
Right. And watch out for Google.
Yeah.
And they're
going to
look at this and say, maybe we ought to do something like that too with Google Home.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Now, coming up, we've got Nate OG. That's right, the newest member of the Twit crew. And he wants to show you Nintendo Switch owners a little something-something. If you're looking for something else to play other than Mario Kart or Legend of Zelda, you may want to see his review of Tumbleseed. But first, I want to tell you a little something about Upside. It's the summer, and this means that we're going to be traveling. Some of us travel for business. Some of us travel for pleasure. But most of us have fallen into the regular old routine. You're going to jump on the internet. You're going to look for your lowest price fare. You're going to find a hotel that you want to stay at. And then you're just going to hope that it all goes together, which it always does, right? Of course not. Travel is one of the most frustrating things that we can do because things often aren't planned enough. Well, that's when you need Upside. Now, this episode of the New Screen Savers is brought to you by the best new way for small and medium-sized companies to book business travel. Upside.com is a revolutionary site brought to you by Jay Walker. He's the founder of Priceline. Upside bundles flights and hotels together for one low price. Not only will companies save money on business travel, but Upside will give you a free gift every time you book a trip. You can choose gift cards from over 50 top brands, including Amazon, Target, and Nordstrom. Oh, it doesn't take that long. It's just 3 minutes to find out how much you can save by booking your flights and hotel together. That's the convenience of Upside.com. There's no need to spend time comparing a long list of choices and prices. Upside instantly finds the top six flights and hotels and lets you choose which level of comfort you want. You get to choose the hotel, the airline, the flight time. You get to choose where your frequent flyer miles go. And if you need help, they have amazing 24/7 concierge-level customer service. You can call, email, chat, or reach them on social before, during, and even after a trip. And if you're a frequent business traveler, your company will save a ton of money. Every time you book a trip at Upside, you'll get a gift card worth $100, $200, even $300. Imagine that. You can get even more with overseas trips. And your gift card arrives via email just 72 hours after booking your trip. There's no limit on trips or gift cards, so Upside really doesn't have a downside. If you travel for business or know people who do, you have to tell them about Upside. And here's what we can do for you. Because you are loyal listeners of TWIT, you can book your business travel at Upside.com and get a $100 minimum gift card on your first trip. And use promo code NSS. That's Upside.com and promo code NSS. Save big on travel and get a big gift card every trip at Upside. Minimum purchase required. See site for complete details. And we thank Upside for their support of the New Screensavers. Now, coming up next in a few minutes, we're going to go talk to Richard Marks over with Sony VR. If you want to see the newest, the latest, the greatest, the coolest for the PlayStation VR, you're going to want to stick with us. But first, let's go ahead and take a look at Nate and his review of Tumbleseed.
When the Switch launched, one of the most hyped up features was what Nintendo calls HD Rumble. The Switch's controllers use vibrating motors to offer haptic feedback that is much more precise and detailed than the in-game shaking you'd find on an Xbox or PlayStation controller. Only one game, Nintendo's own 1-2 Switch, has really been able to show off what HD Rumble can do. That is, until Tumbleseed arrived at a price of $15 just a few days ago. Tumbleseed is colorful, fun, and difficult. Really, really difficult. While you can play this game on a PlayStation or a PC, playing it on the Switch takes everything to another level because of the way the game uses HD Rumble. In Tumbleseed, you maneuver your joysticks to move a small marble of a character, technically a seed named TS, using a beam that rolls our hero along. Simply put, HD Rumble offers more fidelity on both the Switch's Joy-Cons and the Switch Pro Controller. Instead of just seeing your character roll along with the occasional faint controller shake, HD Rumble lets you feel each push and pull. While Tumbleseed is a tough game on any platform, I found that I died less on the Switch than I did on the PlayStation because of the super detailed feedback HD Rumble provides. Still, I've managed to kill TS dozens and dozens of times in this game. Each time I do, I have to start the game's virtual mountain climb course over again. Another challenge? The terrain changes slightly each time I play. The pits and creatures I had to dodge and defeat before are new places every time I take a new stab at making my way through the game. The game features 5 procedurally generated worlds, and there are more than 30 seed powers to find that let you change how TS looks and what TS does. The plant seed lets you plant checkpoints so you respawn further up the climb. The thorn seed gives you a weapon to fight off bad guys. The heart seed lets you create new hearts to extend your in-game life. Oh, and you have to collect crystal shards along the way to fuel those powers. Tumbleseed is both great when you're plopped into your favorite chair for the evening or playing in short bursts on the go. Tumbleseed also shows just how good HD Rumble can be when developers take the time to use the tech. Sure. In Nintendo's own 1-2 Switch, you can virtually feel the stretch of a cow udder, the clicking turn of a safe lock. But aside from that and Tumbleseed, there really aren't many games that show off what HD Rumble can do. Hopefully, these games will inspire other developers to take advantage of this feature, because as Tumbleseed shows, HD Rumble really can make a game more immersive and fun. My name is Nathan Olivatis-Giles. You can find me on the new Screensavers on Saturdays and other Twitch shows throughout the week.
This is my VR controller. There are many like it, but this one is mine. I'm here with Dr. Richard Marks. No, not that Richard Marks. I know what you're thinking. This man is a geek at heart. With PlayStation VR, Dr. Marks, what is this? I saw this at the Game Developers Conference, and it was fascinating. At first, I thought someone was holding PVC piping, and then I saw them playing VR, and it's actually kind of amazing. Tell me about this.
So this is our new PlayStation VR AIM controller. It comes out and works with the PlayStation VR headset that we have here. And there's a game that's launching with it called Farpoint, and we have that game to show you later. But it has a really good feel to it. It's very simple but very ergonomic. So when you're playing, of course, when you're in VR, you can see any kind of weapon, and then it kind of matches because it's so simple of a design that you're holding.
What I love about this design is Sony has taken advantage of the fact that you're in VR. There's so many of the controllers that I've seen actually look like battle rifles, which, okay, that's cool when they're hanging on the wall, but in a VR goggle, in a VR headset, you can't actually see it. So what you've done is you've made the most comfortable, the most versatile controller possible, and I just love that. How do you come by that? I mean, I guess the better question here would be to say, you're a doctor. This is things that you study. What is it that you do at Sony?
So my group does a lot of the early prototyping of ideas. So we took the PlayStation Move controller early on and mounted it on something like a two-handed controller you could hold like this. But then the design team is really the people that come in and make it ergonomic. They do a great job. They did a great job with the PlayStation VR to make it comfortable. And similarly, they spent that amount of time on this controller. So the trigger placement is really good. How you hold it and how it kind of fits in your arms is great.
Yeah, that was the first time I dropped on the goggles. I thought, this is going to feel weird. But there is something that just clicks. You hold it right. And even doing something like changing weapons, which I'm not going to do it now, but you would do it by going up over your shoulder. It feels like, yeah, I'm reaching back and I'm grabbing a new weapon. Now, funny story, my co-host for Know How actually punched one of our producers because he was playing a different game and got a little too animated. So safety tip.
Yeah, that's why this is soft.
Yeah, good point. When you're looking at designing either a new accessory or a new VR environment, what are the cues that you have to pick up on? So when you start thinking, this is how people are actually going to use this, or this is how they're going to interact with this VR environment, what are the most important things that other developers might forget?
Well, when we were doing it, we were thinking, you have the DualShock, which is a great general-purpose controller. The PlayStation Move is really good for kind of one-handed interactions, reaching out and picking things up. But for a first-person shooter, you really want something that feels like you're doing what you're doing in the game. And that's why we felt it's important enough to make a dedicated piece of hardware just for that. So having things match what you're doing in the experience is really important.
It looks like it's ambidextrous as well. It looks like it's good for lefties or righties, right? I mean, was that an important goal in the design process?
It's important to me. I'm a lefty, so
yeah. Okay.
But you can map the sticks to be either way, and you can also hold it either way.
Nice.
So. Let's go ahead and call over your colleague here, because we need someone to demonstrate how this is actually going to work. Because one of the questions I have is, we've got a Far Cry demo, which is interesting. It's a fun game, but sometimes it feels as if VR is just topped on top of an already great game. What does this do for the actual gaming experience? What does VR plus this controller do for someone who's playing Far Cry, say, for the fifth time?
Is it Far Cry or Farpoint?
Or sorry, Farpoint.
And that's not a Star Trek tie-in, right?
No.
Okay, just making sure for next generation fans.
So when you have the AIM controller, when you look down, you see the weapon that you're holding, and you actually see your whole body, you see your arms, and because of it knows where the weapon is, it can actually do the inverse kinematics to map your whole body. And the immersion that adds is huge. You can move it around. And also, you can play co-op, and then you see another player, and you see their motion of their whole body the same way. So it gives a really rich feeling of the player and other players.
Just watching this demonstration, I love how everything seems to be locked properly. I mean, when he's turning his gun, when he's looking at his gun, it's so smooth. This is one of the things when we saw PlayStation VR before its release at GDC a while back. It astounded me that you could do it at that price point. All the other VR controllers, all of the other VR headsets were so much more expensive, and the hardware was so much higher end. I thought, well, this has to be a dumbed down version. It's really not. How did you get a smooth experience into something like this?
Well, we have a lot of experience as a consumer electronics company, right? We're used to making large amounts of good quality, good value hardware, and that's what we use the same formula for this. We have good relationships with all the manufacturers of components, and you know, it's something that we do as part of our day job.
He switched the shotgun, which is my favorite weapon, but I forget every once in a while you have to reload it. All right, one of the other little nags about VR is having to pick up every once in a while like a standard controller because there's something on the tool that you're using doesn't do all the functions. Can you walk me through the functions on the AIM controller? What, do I have to use anything in conjunction with this, or is that a one-stop shop?
No, it has everything that a DualShock has on it already. So it has two analog sticks, it has the triggers, and it has the symbol buttons and the D-pad right there next to your thumb. So you have everything you might need to navigate menus or anything like that. So it's a fully functional controller in every way.
Yeah, now, and of course, it's got vibration.
Yeah.
What about batteries? Battery life on some of these devices that I saw in the prototype stage weren't great. I mean, I played with one controller at GDC that they said, well, yeah, you know, you can get an hour of gameplay. That didn't seem right.
All of our controllers, that's another big area that we focus on. And it, of course, charges just through the regular kind of USB charging mechanism. So easy to charge.
We've got a very common question from Beatmaster in the chat room. And he wants to know, how is the accuracy of this compared to, say, using a keyboard and a mouse or just sticks? Because, you know, if it's just going to add difficulty, I don't know if that's something I want in my gaming setup.
Well, this game is a VR game, so you're in VR. So using mouse and keyboard is actually really challenging in VR anyways. But it's really precise, and you can see the weapon. And you can look right down it and shoot. I mean, you can hold it up to your eye. That feeling is really good. So I don't think there's any kind of comparison to anything else except for when you can hold it up and look right down the barrel like that. So that's one of the selling points we always emphasize, is it's very precise.
I played a little bit of this in the pre-show, and what I discovered was I really shouldn't ever play video games. I'm really bad at this. I normally count on my co-host to do the video game segments. Tell me a little bit about Farpoint. What's the setting? Is it just an alien shoot-up, or am I playing a campaign here?
Yeah, so there's a story. There's actually, you're there to recover some scientists that have been left there to study the planet, and some things have gone wrong, so you're there to try to find them. There's little holographic messages that the scientists have left you, and so you go there, and they tell you a story, and you're trying to find where they've gone on the planet. And you run into a lot of progressively larger creatures as you go.
And those are vomiting acid, right?
Yeah, that's sitting spiders.
That's just rude. Wait, whoa, no!
It gets quite challenging. But there are more weapons that you can get. So he's using the assault rifle and shotgun here, but you get like a plasma gun and a rail gun, all sorts of more powerful weapons. And in VR, what you can't get here on TV, of course, is these things feel huge get to the bosses. They just feel giant.
That's the thing. I mean, you can watch someone on a 2D screen, and you'll say, okay, that's an interesting game. But when you're actually immersed in something, it's an entirely different experience. I know that's cliche, but it really is. The fact that it responds to my body rather than just my thumbs, That's something new for a lot of people.
And I mean, something runs out at you. When it gets near you, you feel it. And if you look down at your feet and there it is, that's a huge effect that you just can't get any other way.
I do not like that effect.
Yeah.
That's not my favorite. You know, I think the only thing that could be better is if you had like a haptic suit. Let's go full Ready Player One. And I start to feel something gnawing on my ankle. That would probably be a little disconcerting. I'm not sure if I want that sensation.
Not quite there yet.
Not quite there. Now, when we're looking at this, and you're charting the path for PlayStation and PlayStation VR, where do we go with this? Is it more scare games? Is it the jump scares that are going to make VR? Or is this going to become an experience that everyone's just going to want? Like when do you see titles that you would never even consider publishing not in VR?
Well, we're definitely seeing that now. There are some great titles that do both VR and non-VR, but there's some titles that really only work in VR. This game was designed completely focused on VR. But there's games like Star Trek Bridge Crew, which is coming out soon.
Right.
And that feels like you're there together on the... And that really feels right for VR. I mean, that's not a a horror game in any way, right? So I think people have started exploring the space quite well, and we're starting to see some of the fruits of that labor now.
Yeah, let's ask about some of those fruits. And don't have to say anything that's gonna spoil any of the surprises that Sony's got coming up. But when you look at the state of VR right now, and I'm not talking just about what Sony's done with the PSVR, but VR in general, what do you think is missing? What's the thing that you think if they get it, if they master that technology, that's the aha, that's the, okay, now this is starting stakes?
I actually think the technology isn't really what's holding us back in any ways. I think what we're seeing, and I think we're about to launch in VR, that's what I really feel, is that when you're there with somebody else in VR, that's when it becomes the most magical. Yeah. Co-presence is the term that people use. And it's that feeling when you can like just reach out and give somebody something else, and you're working together to accomplish something, that just doesn't have an equal. And right now it's early, so it's hard to have a multiplayer game that you really put all your eggs in the multiplayer basket. But I think that's really where it's going to take off.
What's difficult about that? I mean, we've had co-op on networked devices for the longest time. What makes it challenging it in VR?
Well, first of all, the numbers of people right now, you know, starting a new system, you have to get enough people to make multiplayer make sense. But then from a technical point of view, the physics and things when you reach out and have very close contact with somebody else is something that we don't do a lot in games now. So if I hand you an object and you grab it, now we're both exerting physics on it and we're both doing this over a network.
You definitely need some haptic feedback for that. Yeah.
So people are working on that and there's some really great strides, but it's still challenging.
So what about, I'm going to throw out a fishing question here, what about cross-platform interactions, right? I know it gets tricky, everyone's in the market and they're trying to do their best, but you know, what about a game that is cross-platform, just like we see today with some of the games, right, that work on PlayStation and Xbox and PC? What about the same thing for VR? So I'm using an Oculus Rift or one of the other systems, and I can hand them the the secret key or package or whatever it is.
Well, we have done multiplayer games that are cross-platform with PC before, so we've done that in the past. Right. I think it's more on a case-by-case basis, so I think we don't have anything to announce right now, but I don't see why there'd be an absolute impossibility there.
Right, right. As a marketer, I see that as a way to overcome those obstacles, right? It's like, okay, let's make something that everybody can play, and then the best man wins with whoever has the best technology at that point.
It does add some load balancing challenges to the game designer.
Sure.
And I mean, when people play on PlayStation, we know exactly everyone's playing on the same even ground platform. But with a PC, you just don't know what's being connected. And if it slows the game down in something like that, you don't want... That's extra challenges from that to work out.
Let me ask about that development. We hear sometimes of, it's always a challenge developing cross-platform, but does it become especially tricky when you're developing cross-VR platforms? Because PSVR doesn't work like the HTC Vive, doesn't work like the Oculus Rift. There are obvious similarities, but, I mean, the back ends are pretty significantly different. Is it just too difficult to develop for three different VR systems?
I don't think it's too difficult, and definitely some of the game developers have made their game multi-platform for all the platforms. And for online, I mean, you do have different controllers and things, so you might have slightly different capabilities that you have to figure out how to accomplish that on every platform simultaneously, but I don't think there's any fundamental thing stopping it.
Aaron, have you done a lot of VR work at your makerspace? Are people getting into this yet?
Not really. I mean, they dabble with Google Cardboard and things like that, but in terms of gaming, I mean, that's... Yeah, it's more the home user, really. But I think there are some interesting applications for VR in the makerspace world, right? So if you don't own a 3D printer, for example, you could have a virtual 3D printer and see how it works, you know, and learn how things happen. Put your hands where normally you wouldn't put your hands, you know, in the table saw or something like that. For beginners to learn, oh, maybe I shouldn't touch that spinning sharp thing. I think that there are some interesting applications there. I wanted to ask specifically about this device. Is it compatible with any VR game out there, or is it just certain titles that will have compatibility for this device?
Well, so this launches next week, so it's not even quite out yet, but I guess on Tuesday officially it launches. But it launches with Farpoint, and there are four other games that have been announced that it works with already. So there's the Brookhaven Experiment, there's Arizona Sunshine, which is coming over to our platform soon. That was a really popular game on the PC VR system, so we're excited about that.
Cool.
So yeah, And more developers are...
More to come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about for independence? I know there's things like the Unity engine, mm-hmm. but Sony has made some decent noise about really trying to pull in independence into the developing community and yeah. making sure they have the tools and the wisdom that they need to be able to develop for the platform. What are the challenges of doing that with VR? Because, you know, obviously it's a different way of designing. It's a different way of thinking. It's, again, it's getting past the cliche VR stuff, which is having stuff jump out at you just for the jump scare. What are you doing? What is Sony doing to sort of encourage better development?
Well, I think the indies, VR is one of the best options they have because it is kind of an even playing field right now. It's new. It's the Wild West. We don't know what the best ideas are quite yet for VR. So you can have a small team and still come up with a great new idea that hasn't happened yet. And like you mentioned, the middleware engines have made it really easy right. technically to support VR. So you pretty much just click a checkbox and all of a sudden you have VR. Of course, the design of your game needs to take that into account. So you need to have something interesting to do in VR. But as far as technically making it happen and getting it in on the screen and in the headset, that's easy.
By the way, I did notice that scientist for some reason was holding a gun. I don't think scientists are supposed to be armed.
Well, there's some pretty big pretty big bugs on this. Maybe it was just a bug killer, you know.
Dr. Richard Marks from PlayStation VR, thank you so very much for bringing this in. Now, again, this will be available next week. What's the price point? If someone already has a PlayStation and the VR headset, what will the new controller cost them?
So Farpoint by itself is $49.99, mm-hmm. and then Farpoint bundled with the PlayStation VR AIM controller is $79.99.
And if they want to find out more about this, more about the PSVR, where should they go?
Just definitely go to PlayStation.com. We have a lot of stuff about VR and about our controller there. So,
sir, awesome. Thank you very much for talking to us. Thank you for sharing this. I think after the show, I'm going to have to squash some what are the spiders? I'm not sure what they are, but they need to die.
I think you're projecting Earth things onto this planet,
that's right?
fuzzy xenomorphs, acid-shooting xenomorphs.
There you go.
Those things. Coming up next, we're going to be bringing you some call for help. But first, let's go over to Jason Howe, who has a few things to tell us about the latest and greatest for families in the Android ecosystem.
I'm a tech fanatic, and I'm also a parent. So one question for modern parents often centers around when it's a good time to introduce their children to the complex world of technology and how to provide a safe environment for their explorations. Google released Family Link recently to help parents introduce their children to a relatively controlled Google environment. I've been using it for close to a month now. Here are my thoughts. First, by setting up an account through Family Link, you're creating a new Google account for your children that operates on your terms. Setting up a kid's device with Family Link requires that I first create a Google account within the app, then factory reset the device, and finally log into that device with the newly created account. And from there, I have all sorts of controls within the Family Link app on my phone. Location tracking, for example, allows me to keep tabs on where that device is and consequently where my kid is, if they have it. I'm shown recent activity on the device as well as its current state. I can also modify bedtime rules so it won't work between certain hours of the night, as well as setting daily hour limits for the use. As for app control, I'm shown what apps have been installed on the device recently, which reminds me, if my kid tries to install a new app, they will be required to get my permission before install is complete. I'll actually be shown a notification on my device asking if I'm okay with that install, and if I say yes, that app will immediately be installed on their device. I can reject it too. I can set content restrictions for everything that Play touches. So, for example, only show my kids movies that are G-rated and PG-rated, or restrict explicit content in Play Music. I've also tied my credit card to the account, so anything that costs money can be purchased by the child, but only with my explicit permission. Oh, and because of the family library function, everyone in my family now has access to my own library of movies, music, and apps. It's all shared across. One thing I really like about Family Link is that Google allows me to keep YouTube and Chrome off of the device entirely if I choose, something you can't do easily with a normal installation of Android. That lets me keep my kids in the YouTube Kids app, and links out to websites won't actually work until I'm totally comfortable opening up that restriction for them. I've used other apps that control access for parents, like Dinner Time, in the past, and I'm perfectly satisfied switching to Family Link as it's so tightly integrated into the OS and the kid's device. And coupled with a family plan and Play Music, which includes YouTube Red for ad-free YouTube, I feel like I can relax a little bit and let my kids be kids while they use their devices safely. Family Link is free in the Play Store. I'm Jason Howell. You can find me chatting with Megan Maroney about the day's biggest tech news stories every day on Tech News Today, along with Android news on All About Android every Tuesday.
Thank you, Jason Howell. You know, that's been one of the missing pieces, family-oriented computing.
We're
really lagging behind. It's nice to see that Google, that Android is making that effort to give parental controls to devices that are going to be in the hands of kids who maybe make poor decisions. But you were saying it doesn't work properly in all cases.
Yeah, so there are a lot of Google apps that they've been trying to come out with these family services, like the Family Music Plan and things like that, right? The downside to a lot of those is they won't work with Google if you have your domain hosted with Google. Yeah. So it used to be called Google Apps, but that gets confusing now. So if you're like me and you have a domain hosted and you're using Google for that, a lot of times they won't let you do that because they're focusing all of that more on business now, right? As opposed to there was a time when you could sign up and test out their domain service. A lot of people did that and they were excited about it. And, hey, I'm going to use this for, you know, yourlastname.com. It'd be great. And Google really hasn't allowed some of these family-oriented services to work on what used to be called Google Apps. So it's a little bit unfortunate, but maybe someday Google will come around and fix that.
You know, it can also be a little confusing with all of the different apps, platforms, and services that Google has decided to either stop supporting or to change significantly to the point where they're no longer worth it.
Right.
You know, at some point, they're really going to have to start saying, look, we're only going to release things that we're committed to.
Yep.
15 years ago, it was okay to say, we're going to throw a bunch of stuff against the wall and see what sticks. Right. Nowadays, that kind of bothers people.
Yeah, I think so. Especially as they've, you know, it used to be a lot of people like us, right? It was the tech crowd that was using their stuff, and they didn't care if there were some bugs because it was cool and it was fun. But now it's your average Joe that's getting hit by some of these problems, right, that they've had supporting everything that they've put out there. And it's unfortunate, but they'll get there.
What I'd like to see is I'd like to start seeing maybe if you could get an industry consortium to look at all of the parental controls that you should have. So, for example, yes, you should be able to control mobile devices. You should be able to control app loadout. But maybe you get some hooks into the carrier so that you can control how much bandwidth your kids can use.
Yeah.
My network at home, the routers that I test in my lab, most of them have parental controls. Like, for example, my favorite, the Synology, the 2600 AC right now, there's actually an app that the parents can have on their phones, and they can disable their children's devices from connecting to the network, say, after 10 until 7 in the morning, or when they're being punished, when they're being grounded.
Yep.
That's something that I'd like to see in one place rather than I've got one app for my carrier, one app for my apps, one app for the computer at home, one app for the network.
Yeah. Well, let's root for open standards.
Yeah,
you never know.
Next up, we've got a call for help. It's one of my favorite times of the show where we get to reach out and answer a question that one of our wonderful audience members is having. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of the new Screensavers. Folks, when you think of a good time, when you think of something that's fun, something that's exciting, something that really gets your blood pumping, you think of getting mortgages, don't you? No, you don't. Of course you don't. It's a horrible, horrible time. We all hate it because it's just the worst ever. At least it was before Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage is a sponsor of the new Screensavers, and they are the best way of making the big decisions when it comes to choosing a mortgage lender. It's important to work with someone who you can trust, who has your best interest in mind, and that's why we here at TWIT use Rocket Mortgage. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. You don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage in just minutes. This is the mortgage process for a digital generation. We are not accustomed to going to a back closet and pulling out banker's boxes filled with our records. All of our information is online. And Rocket Mortgage makes it so easy to share that information so you can get the right mortgage tailored just for you. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure that you get the mortgage solution that's going to work for where you are in your life and what you're hoping to achieve.
whether you're looking to buy a home, refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan by using Rocket Mortgage. That's right, folks. Skip the bank. Skip the waiting and go completely online at quickenloans.com/NSS. That's quickenloans.com/NSS. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of the new screensavers. It's time for Call for Help. We've got James in Florida who has a question that is very well suited for our maker in residence, Aaron Newcomb.
Hey, guys. I have 3 Raspberry Pis that I use in my house as media centers. And what I would like to have is a case that funneled all the cords out the back of the it and was large enough that I could put a 3.5-inch hard drive and store my media on that. That way, if I go to a hotel or maybe my in-laws' house, I could take it with me and just plug it in like you'd plug in any like a DVD player or something like that and not have this mess of cables and wires going in various places. My second question is, I see a lot of Raspberry Pi competitors like Orange Pi, Arduino makes one. I think Asus just came out with a single board device. Do you need to have a different version of the software to run on those, or do they run with the Raspberry Pi software? So can I just load the same version of Kodi onto an Orange Pi or a Banana Pi that might have different specs and be able to use it, or is there a version of Kodi made for those devices specifically? Okay, thanks. Bye.
Great questions.
These are
James.
Good questions.
Oh, great questions. And well, we've got Aaron Newcomb. He's the man to ask. Well, let's answer that backwards. We'll talk about the case later on. But what about it? We've seen since the introduction of the Raspberry Pi, you've had other companies. I'm not going to say that they're copying, but I'm saying they're trying to play on the popularity of a low-cost, very capable computer.
Yep.
What about things like the Banana Pi? What about all those other Raspberry Pi alternatives? Are they completely compatible across the board?
So I wouldn't call them completely compatible in that you can't take the package that was built for Raspberry Pi and copy it over on a USB stick and install it and expect it to work, right? But what you can do is you can run a similar distribution as Raspberry Pi. So Raspberry Pi runs typically now it's Debian Jesse,
right?
And you can run Debian on all of these other platforms as well. I've used Orange Pi, I've used Banana Pi, I haven't used the new Asus yet, but all of them run some version of Linux, and particularly a Debian version of Linux that you can then install Kodi the same way that you would install Kodi on the Raspberry Pi. In other words, apt-get install Kodi, right? And so as long as if you're familiar with the way things work on the Raspberry Pi and you like the way they work in Linux, then you can install. And one of the versions that I would recommend is one called Armbian, right? So it's Debian for ARM. And they've done some tremendous work in supporting these other boards. And so if you're running Armbian, then you're going to be running Debian Jesse, and you can just do the same kind of software installs that you could on Raspberry Pi. It makes it really easy. So although technically it's not the exact same software, it's similar software. It's just been built to run on that particular distribution of Linux that runs on those devices. I hope that makes sense. Yeah. But if not, we'll buy my book and find out all about it later. There's more information. We'll get to that in a minute.
And of course, you know, Linux knowledge is really Linux knowledge across the platform. It's just getting the initial OS on there. You have to get the one that's right for that device, for that processor.
Right.
You know, are you running an ARM processor? Are you running a Qualcomm processor? Find the distro that's going to work for you. But once you're in, Linux is going to work like Linux.
Once you're in, Linux is pretty much going to work like Linux. Obviously, there's different distributions. If you're running one that's based on Red Hat, then you're going to use a different tool set. But like I said, most people, average user, they're going to be running some sort of version of Debian. So stick with that, and you should have no problems. The other thing I'll say about those devices is that some of them come with different capabilities. They're cheap enough. I would definitely recommend checking them out. I've got several of these at home. And one of the things they do really well, as opposed to Raspberry Pi, is they run Android. I've mentioned this on shows before.
Yes.
So if you want to run Android as a media center instead of Kodi, which is something that I've done at home, try downloading the Android build and run that on these things and see if you like running Android. That's my first foray into running Android as a full-blown desktop, right, on a big monitor and everything was on an Orange Pi, and it works great. So,
you know, I get the question every once in a while, well, which one is better? And it's hard to answer that because they do different things well.
Yeah.
I've got an Orange Pi. I've got a Banana Pi. I've got the Raspberry Pi. I normally default to the Raspberry Pi because that's the one I have experience with. But I know certain things like network functions work better on other devices. Yeah. So I think you're right. If you're going to start to dabble in this, get all of the devices. They're inexpensive enough where you can afford to get them all.
Yeah.
And then run the installation on each one of them and sure. See, is this better for me? Does this work? Do I miss keyframes with a Banana Pi versus a Raspberry Pi? That's really going to tell you which one you should use for the project.
Yeah, and one caveat, just to tag on to what you just said, is that one thing you should know is that although there's a lot of these devices out there, they don't all have the same level of support as Raspberry Pi does.
Yeah.
So that could be, if you're a new user or, maybe somebody who uses the forums a lot to find out how to do this or how to do that, you're going to find a lot more support if you're using Raspberry Pi than you are these other platforms. And that might be a downfall for a lot of people because they're like, I can't find the information I'm looking for. And it's just because they don't have as broad of a user base.
Yeah. And just remember, these are all development products. That's the whole idea. They're to tinker with. So if you're expecting to get the same kind of support that you would by going to a Genius Bar, that's not going to happen. You got to reach out to the community. These are the people who they probably have more experience than you. I know they have way more experience than I do, and they've probably run into the issues that you're seeing, and they might have a solution for you. And most of the time, that solution is as simple as running something in the command line, and boom, everything works properly.
Yeah, definitely. We should probably get to his question about the case as well.
For me, this is simple because everything I use is 3D printed. Mm-hmm. So I was able to design something that stored not a 3.5-inch drive, but a 2.5-inch SSD. And the reason why I went that way was because I can power that directly off the USB bus.
Exactly.
Not so much with a 3.5-inch drive. So I'm thinking you're going to need something with an external power supply that powers both the 3.5-inch drive and the Raspberry.
Right. If you really are stuck on the 3.5-inch drive, it's going to be difficult. I would definitely go with the 2.5-inch. You can find those in all kinds of sizes now, so you'll have plenty of space to use. And if you don't want to design it yourself, which I would recommend because it's fun and you'll learn something, there is a case that I found out on Thingiverse. I didn't find one on Amazon or other places. I'm sure there's lots of them out there.
I built this one.
But I found one on Thingiverse that actually gives you the room to put in a 2.5-inch drive as well as a power supply and keep it. I think what he's going for, which is, this box that you just plug into the TV and plug into the wall, and it works. And I think this build could be something that you might want to take a look at. Also, if you don't have a 3D printer at home, just a reminder, there are great companies out there that will print this for you.
Shapeways.
Shapeways is one. Yeah. 3D Hubs is another. Or
find a makerspace.
You knew
nearby.
Where I was going. Yeah, if you can find a local makerspace that has a 3D printer, I'm sure there'd be someone there that would help you print it for either for free or maybe you buy them a beer or something like that.
Aaron, I heard that there's this makerspace in Benicia.
That's right.
It's fantastic.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
I wish I knew the people who ran that.
I know a little bit about that. so we run our own makerspace, and we actually do this quite often for people. They'll come in for an open house, not really interested in being a member, but then they'll come back later and they'll say, I kind of have this thing that I'd love to print. I don't really know how to do it. Can someone here just do it for me? And it's like, yeah, sure, no problem. I mean, we're all about learning. So hopefully as part of that process, maybe they learn something about 3D printing and maybe they'll get inspired to make something else. So.
I did a little session here late at night with drones. I showed a group of people how to...
You did. That was awesome.
...goes into them and how they fly. Most of them flew into the trees.
But. Yeah, we did. We finally got that one down, by the way. It was up there for a while, but...
We had one that was trapped in a tree for 2 years.
2 years?
Brian flew it up into a redwood.
Wow.
And his brother, who is now a park ranger, found it. It had fallen down after two years.
My word.
It still works, so they're pretty much bulletproof.
That's awesome.
And the battery had to be replaced, obviously.
Yeah.
The other thing, and I will say this, and you mentioned it, really seriously consider not going with the 3.5-inch drive. Go with a 2.5-inch. It will reduce your footprint by at least 40%. And then it means that you don't have to have that huge power adapter inside of it. You can run it off of a 5-volt that will power everything.
Yep.
Just
check your amperage, make sure you've got enough. Raspberry Pi is going to cost you at least 2 amps. They recommend 2.5 amps. Mm-hmm. So then just check the amperage requirements on the 2.5-inch drive and add those two things up, as well as any other peripherals you might be using, and you'll get what kind of power supply in terms of the amperage rating that you'll need to also put in that case.
James, I hope that answers your question. And if it doesn't, what you're going to want to do is watch our show Know How, because you can actually ask Brian and I, and maybe we'll design one for
They'll
you.
They'll do it.
Yeah, we'll do it.
They'll show you.
It's kind of what we do. Now, next week, Leo will be back, and Jason Howell is going to be his co-host. If you have any questions for them, it's really simple to send a question to Call for Help.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
All right, we've got the mailbag coming up, which I love because it's definitely. I get to sit in Uncle Leo's chair. It feels kind of weird. But before we go to that, we just briefly talked about your makerspace. You actually just put out a book.
I did. I put out a book. It's weird to say. I wrote a book. That's something I never thought I would do. But I did. I put a book out. It's called Linux for Makers. The great folks at Maker Media asked me to write this book for them because it's a little bit of a hole. And the inspiration for this book was really... As we just mentioned, I run a makerspace. People come in, they'll get a Raspberry Pi for Christmas, they'll get a kit or something, or they'll give it to a child and they'll come in not really knowing what all is involved in running Raspberry Pi. And then they get a little bit, it's like, oh, there's Linux running here, and this thing said to drop to the command line and run some sort of command. What does that do? I don't understand. I'm just following along something on the internet. And then they run into a problem and they don't know how to fix it because they don't know how Linux works. So the whole goal of this was geared towards makers that are running Linux specifically on these SBCs and specifically in this book on the Raspberry Pi to help them understand some of the concepts that are going to help them be more successful as they build projects running on those SBCs.
You know, what I like about this is the way that you couched everything. You wrote it for people who are using OS X and Windows.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, you cover all the basics. If you're having trouble figuring out how you change things, because in Windows there's a menu, mm-hmm. or in OS X there's a dropdown, you do the direct correlation to how you do it on Linux. I love that. That's exactly what I need, because, you know, sometimes I'm thinking, well, maybe Linux just doesn't do this. Maybe this is not something that the designers thought of.
Right. And the fact is that when most people, once they get over the hurdle of actually understanding Linux and dropping down to the command line, which you don't always have to do, but I go into when you do and when you don't in the book. Once you feel the power, I feel like I'm going back to an old Nintendo commercial or something. But once you feel the power of using the command line, a classic example I give is if you open up a file browser, right, and you want to go find a file and copy it to another location, what do you have to do? You have to double click, right? You have to open the application, and then you double click on a folder, and then double click on the next one, and double click on the next one, and double click on the next one. Oh, there's the file I want, right? You know, then you right click, you copy, you know, then you go back to the directory tree and find the other folder, and then right click and paste. You can do that in Linux in about 2 seconds. As fast as you can type, you can make that happen. But you have to understand what the directory structure looks like on the command line and how you access it. So those are the types of things that I think as people get more comfortable with the command line and they understand how quick it is to do some of these tasks, they're really going to start preferring it, right? And especially when you're building a project like the laser maze that we built, for example. Mm-hmm. It's much quicker for us to move a bunch of files from one place to another just to drop to the command line and do it. And I think people will actually appreciate how to do that on the command line. It'll help them be more successful as they think about building a project on a board like the Raspberry Pi.
Now, a lot of people, when they think of Linux for Makers, they're thinking it's just the Raspberry Pi. I mean, that's going to be if they're not already living in the Linux world, that's going to be their primary point of exposure.
Yeah.
But it's not just Raspi.
That's right.
I mean, there's so many different things that you can do with Linux. I use Linux servers extensively that will help with making projects. I mean, for me, it's the using if this then that.
Right.
It works really well to put a headless, low-power Linux server in a closet somewhere and just handle all of that. Yeah. Do you touch on that?
I do. I go over that, and I try to call out when things are different. But most of the information that you find in this book is going to be helpful for you, no matter where you're running Linux. I go over things like what are permissions, what are users, how do you add users, how do you use the command line effectively, how do you access the command line history. So all of those things are applicable not just to the Raspberry Pi, but to pretty much anywhere that you're running any sort of Linux, with some exceptions in, you know, as long as you're running a bash prompt on a Linux host, which is, you know, most of the consumer grade distributions that are out there, you're going to find something in here that'll really help you out.
You know, this is very well timed because both Brian, my co-host on KnowHow, and I, we have this thing that we kind of do when we mess up a Linux distro on the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
We just start over.
It's
so difficult for me to figure out what I did wrong that often it's less intensive for me to just take a fresh SD card that I've already flashed with the latest distro, plug it in, let it do it again, and then I just run my instructions. But, of course, there's that part of me that says this is not the right way to do it. Yeah. I should figure out what I did, and I should figure out how to fix it.
Is this advanced enough for me to be able to do that? Can this help me figure out what I broke?
It will. It'll help you figure out, like, a common problem that I think a lot of people have. Let's say they install a web server that they want to run, right? And then they create an HTML file, and they drop that in the right location, and it doesn't work. And it says, permission denied or it can't run. And one of the things that a lot of people struggle with is this concept, like I mentioned, of users and permissions. And they don't realize that the fact that the web server actually runs as a specific user, and it requires that file that you just put in there to be owned by that user, right? And so that might be something where you say, look, this worked before. I don't understand why it's not working. I'm just going to start over again. And then you've got to go through and load the operating system, and it takes you a few hours to get that done. So hopefully some of those tips in the book will actually help. As if you read it and you understand what the concepts are, things like the file structure, things like users and permissions, things like what is the shell, how do you use the shell effectively, things like that. If you understand those things, it'll make your life a lot easier when you're troubleshooting those problems.
We just did a project about making a Raspberry Pi Tor, one that was sort of customized for our audience. And we had a group of our fans who were saying, why did you take so much time showing us step by step by step? Couldn't you just make us a script and install everything? And the answer is yes, we could have, but we kind of want to show you those intermediate steps. It's important to know how to make a new file. It's important to know how to change the permissions. It's important to know how to change the ownership, because you do that all the time. And when you take the mystery out of something like change mod, then then suddenly it goes from just something I'm typing to, that's the function
that
I need
makes
to
sense.
Invoke.
I agree completely. And the other thing I talk about, I mentioned in the book, especially there's an appendix that talks about the history of Linux and why open source is important, right? If we were comparing this to what you would do, let's say, on Windows, you couldn't go through those steps, because those steps are masked by a setup.exe file, or it's being run as an executable, and you have no idea what's going on. But in the world of Linux, it's really all based on open source software. So you can break down those commands one by one and see, here's exactly what's happening in step by step, and I can understand how to get from point A to point B because that software is open and available. And so it's incredibly important, and so hopefully in the book people will pick up on that as well. For history geeks out there, I talk about where, the roots of Linux and where it came from, and Richard Stallman and Linus Torvalds and all those people. And so if you want to dig deeper and know more about what the roots of Linux are, I've also got just the tip of the iceberg in there for you to digest as well.
That is Linux for Makers by Aaron Newcomb. Of course, you can find this now. You can
go
to Amazon and get yourself a copy.
Absolutely.
You're also going to be at Maker Faire.
Yes.
Next week.
I'll be at Maker Faire Saturday and Sunday doing talks. I forget what times. You can look them up on the schedule. But I'll be doing talks about the book, some of the concepts in the book. And I believe they'll have the book there to purchase as well. So if I'm there and you're there and you buy the book, come find me. I'll sign it for you.
And by the way, if you are going to Maker Faire, guess what? Leo Laporte, Nate OG, and myself, and some of the Twit crew, are going to be at the show on Friday. If you want, drop on by. We'd love to see you, especially if you bring your makes. Bring the things that you've built. Bring the things that you're most proud of. And we're going to take some pictures and video for use on KnowHow. So again, Maker Faire, this coming Friday. I think the doors open at noon. You won't be there. You'll be there on Saturday.
I won't be there on Friday because I got to work, but I'll be there Saturday and Sunday. And I think I've got enough books here. If anybody in the audience wants one, I'm happy to sign one, and you can take it with you if you're interested.
Okay. Maybe you can help me with one last thing, since you are my Linux guru. I have gotten into this nasty, nasty habit of saying sudo. And I know this is silly, but when I was learning Linux, Phil Collins was big, and there was that song, sudo. And so I say sudo.
I'm with you.
I know I should say sudo, substitute sudo. User do.
Right.
But can I say sudo without being laughed at?
No.
Damn.
It's not going to happen. It depends on what crowd you're in, right? But on your shows, I know those guys are technical, and they will laugh you out the door. So.
Dang it.
Yeah, you're going to have to. It's like the gift GIF kind of thing. You're going to have to pick one and stick with it, I think.
But sudo just doesn't sound
sudo.
Right.
Sudo. Sudo. It sounds like a dog or something. Sudo. Here's sudo.
All right. Well, let's go and head over to the living room for some mailbag. But, as we go over, let me ask you another question.
Sure.
When you do maker projects at your makerspace, how do you decide between doing something like the press to pound steel into its right shape, or, say, use a 3D printer? What's your thought process?
Well, it really depends on what you're going to do with the end product, right? So if you are going to let's say, use it somewhere where there's a lot of rotational force or there's a lot of metal-on-metal type of contact, then, yeah, you're going to want to do it out of metal. But in a lot of cases, you can actually 3D print something, and even if it doesn't last that long, it only costs you a couple cents, right? So go ahead and make 20 or 100 of them and then have them around. If you don't mind replacing that part every once in a while, it's fine. Also, I will add that 3D printers some 3D printers, not all of them, are now capable of printing composite materials.
Yes.
So you can print a metal composite material and it will last a lot longer, or a wood composite material, and you can sand it and stain it and things like that. You do require special nozzles, though, when you do that. You can't use the softer metal nozzles. But if you really wanted to get into that and 3D print something that is mostly metal, you can absolutely go ahead and do that now.
I actually had to replace the entire hot end on my... But that's not actually that difficult.
It's not too difficult. Yeah. It's a little intimidating, but once you do it, it's like, oh, that wasn't too bad. Yeah.
It's time for the mailbag. We've got to do something for this. I want to make this remote control for Leo. That would just be fun. It would probably hurt someone, but you know, a death in the studio is worth a good gag.
Of course.
That's right. Linux for makers, folks. There's no one who knows Linux quite like Tux.
There's good old Tux.
Actually, let's make him your companion. You get to choose one of these. Which one would you like?
Doesn't matter. Let's pick this one.
All right. Why don't you go first?
All right. All right, so this says, I have Nest cameras in my home, which are Wi-Fi dependent. My question, is there a cellular device that could take over my router connection to the net if my cable service goes down or my cable line is cut? It should go back to cable connection when service is restored. And this is from Ron.
Yes, that is a great question. Ron, thanks for asking that, because that's actually something that I get a lot about, not just for the cellular connection, but can I get, say, a second broadband connection? If I'm one of those lucky few who live in an area where I can get DSL and cable, or maybe even cable and another cable provider, can I join them? And the answer is yes, sometimes. If you're using a Linux router, if you're using pfSense, super easy.
Yep.
Jump into the IP tables and you can actually configure which connections are used when. Mm-hmm. There are some more advanced solutions that you can buy that will automatically choose the lowest latency for that particular site that you're visiting. But he specifically wants to know if you can use cellular, which is awesome because, you know, it's one of those things that's going to be around. It's sort of the emergency connection. And believe it or not, you probably already have the technology. If you've bought a router in the last 5 years, most likely it has a USB port on the back. If it has a USB port on the back and it's from one of the more modern manufacturers, you probably already support 3G backup.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You've seen these, right?
I've seen them, absolutely. And if it doesn't support it, one thing for the tech-savvy user is they might want to consider installing, if you're able to, OpenWRT, which provides some of that functionality as well. OpenWRT has supported this since version 10.03.1. Had to go look it up. But the technology is out there. A lot of routers you can put this firmware, this other firmware called OpenWRT, which is Linux, running Linux, on your router. And that may also support this. So just in case you have a funky router that might not support it natively out of the box and you're technically savvy enough, I would go check out OpenWRT.
Right. Now, I will say people think that they can plug in two connections and get the full speed of both.
Kind of, but not really.
Because if you're going out on one connection, you have to come back on that connection. Again, the more advanced ones will split up the connections so that you can load balance.
Right.
And if you're using DDWRT, you can actually set some of the LAN ports to be a secondary or even tertiary WAN port.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all possible. Now, by the way, Anthony, if you go back to that link, this is the one that I've been playing with at my lab. This is a Synology router. Again, this is on the higher end because this has a lot of firepower. This is one of those routers that it runs apps on it. So you could say run your media server. You can run your VPN. But one of the things it does, if you zoom in on that back panel again, it does have that USB port that you can use for both connecting, say, hard drives or thumb drives or a 3G dongle. Now, one of the issues here, though, is when you think about where your router might be located, a lot of times they might be located in places that don't get good cell reception. So just be aware of that. If that's the case, then you need to find a 3G or cellular dongle that has an external antenna. And those are not very plentiful. They used to be, but they've kind of gone out of style.
Great advice.
I, by the way,
the very first cellular modem I ever had, I was reviewing some product from SonicWall.
Mm-hmm.
They had, I think it was a TZ-170. It was a sort of a personal firewall based on their technology. Fantastic. Worked really well. But it had a PCMCIA. Those folks at home who are a little older will remember that.
Oh, I remember those. I still got a bunch of them in a cardboard box somewhere.
I can't throw them away. I'm always thinking, I have a SCSI one. I have Ethernet. I have an old modem. And, of course, I have a Sprint card that it got something like 200 kilobits per second.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't great, but it was cellular. And the best thing about it was they forgot to turn it off after my review was done.
Oh, so man.
I had it for 4 years.
That's awesome.
It's like free connectivity.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't complain.
Yeah, sorry about that, Sprint. My bad.
Not anymore, though, right?
No.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I turned it on when I was in Mexico, and I think it racked up like $1,000 in roaming charges, so they probably noticed it at that point. Again,
wow.
I'm really sorry, Sprint. That was my bad. George wants to know, I am finally upgrading my father's PC, biological, not ecclesial, and I have long since left the world of Windows. That sounds kind of sad, actually. It's kind of dirgeful.
Yeah.
Am I able to use his old hard drive as a slave to the new system? I don't want to try and move that stuff over. If so, what kind of hardware would I need to accomplish this? Thanks for your help. George, you're in luck. This is one of the easiest things you ever have to do. There are a lot of products out there that will literally let you take the drive out from the old case, plug it into either a dock or an enclosure, plug it into a USB drive, and you're done. It acts as a full drive. This is one that I've used. Again, there's so many out there. Just find one that fits your price. Do make sure that the reviews are positive, because there are some really bad devices out there that just keep disconnecting. But Sabrin is pretty solid. This is USB 3.0, so it will get you, you do want that. Hopefully you have USB 3 on the new computer, much, much faster. And the nice thing about the dock is it's really easy to take drives in and out. So if, for example, here at Twit, we use drives to warehouse some of our older assets. It makes it very easy to connect. If you want to go for something a bit more permanent, Anthony, we have another link. This one is for an actual enclosure. So you open this thing up, you install the drive, you close it, and now you have the drive forever in this enclosure. Again, you're going to want USB 3. I'm assuming you've got a SATA drive, unless your father's computer is really old, but they do have these for IDE.
They do. Yep.
They do. So just choose the one for you. If you're using Windows on the new box, which I think you are based on the phrasing of your question, you may have to jump into computer management. You may have to go into the disk manager and don't initialize it, but make sure that it shows up.
Yep.
And if it doesn't show up, you may have to right-click it just to add it to the system. But more likely than not, you're going to plug it in. It will show up as a new drive.
It'll show up as a USB drive, and you're good.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, if you're using OS X, it's probably formatted NTFS. If it's formatted NTFS, it means that the Mac will be able to read it. It will not be able to write to the drive, just FYI. But possibly the easiest one that's not Windows is Linux. Mounting a drive on Linux is really simple.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a little bit of technical know-how to be able to do that, but you can absolutely go ahead and just, you know, do a Google search on how do I mount a drive under Linux, or how do I mount a, if you know the partition type, that would be helpful, NTFS or FAT, maybe if it's really old.
Right.
And then find out, how do I mount this under Linux? Hook it up. Run a couple of command lines, and you'll be good to go, because Linux has support for almost every file system on the planet. So,
fantastic.
Easy. Easy peasy.
Well, Aaron, I want to thank you for making the trip up. I know you're a little ill, so...
I am a little under the weather, but, you know, I didn't hack too much. Not that I can remember. Lots of cough drops, lots of medicine. But super fun to be here with you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to work with you. I've worked with you on know-how in the past, and your maker projects are second to none.
Yeah, they're fun.
Now, if they wanted to find out more about you, more about your makerspace in Benicia, or more about what you're going to be doing at Maker Faire, what are some of the ways that people can use to get in touch with you?
Sure, thanks for that. You can follow me. I'm Aaron Newcomb on all the social networks, so Facebook, Twitter, Google+. I still use Google+. You can find me there. Also, BeniciaMakerspace.org. is the website. If you're anywhere in the Northern California area, kind of anywhere north of the city, we even actually have some people from the city that come up to take our welding classes. But if you want to join a makerspace and you're looking for a place that has lots of cool equipment to use and lots of good people, definitely check us out. And again, I'll be at Maker Faire this weekend, so I hope to see a lot of you there.
By the way, thank you for mentioning Google+, because ever since people started leaving Google+, it's become such a nicer place.
It is.
Really, it is the most engaged community we have. We have a group for know-how. Over 11,000, we call them Arquitas, or know-it-alls, And, you know, it's a great place to share ideas. People go in there to find a new project, to ask questions, or to give answers. It's probably one of the favorite things I do here at Twit.
Absolutely. The people that haven't left are the nerds, whether they be the photography nerds, the data nerds, the IT nerds, the maker nerds. Like, they're all still there, and they are very engaging. That's where I get the most responses from a lot of my social media messages, because they are kind of a little bit techie most of the time.
If you want to complain about the latest celebrity and what he or she did or did not do, then go to Facebook.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about tech, come to Google Plus.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Again, thank you so much.
You bet.
I know it was a bit of a trip for you, and I'm just pleased as punch to have you here.
Always glad to be here.
Yeah. Don't forget, we've got a newsletter that you really should subscribe to. If you want to find out what's going on behind the scenes at Twit, you just go to twit.tv/newsletter. You get inside news announcements, plus you can find out what's coming up on future shows. We're doing a better job here at Twit, thanks to one of our producers, actually a couple of our producers, who are finally sort of hammering the host, saying, look, you got to tell us who are your guests so that we can share the news with the rest of the network. And again, twit.tv/newsletter. Also, once again, don't forget that Leo Laporte, myself, and Nate Ogee, as well as some of the Twit staff, are going to be at Maker Faire San Mateo next Friday. Show up around noon. We're going to be there signing autographs. We're going to have a tent, a table. I'm not exactly sure where we're going to be, but look for us. We'd love to meet you. Bring your discoveries, bring your makes, bring the things that you're proud of, and we'll just have a good old geeky time. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you get to find out what I'm doing, not just here at Twit, but also when I'm not at Twit. Like last week, I was gone doing something somewhere for someone. It's the other job. I can't really talk about it, so I probably shouldn't have brought it up.
Kind of an important someone.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just say.
You know how they say you should always stop your sentences about 10 seconds before you actually stop?
Yeah, too late.
That's too late. Anyways, until next time, I am Father Robert Ballaser.
And I'm Aaron Newcomb.
And goodbye from the New Screen Series.